Imagine this morning, imagine a world in which salt had not yet been discovered. Hard to do, I know, but just try. Now, suspend your disbelief for just a moment further and imagine what cooking shows would look like in such a world where salt had never been discovered. I hope I'm not the only one that knows about cooking shows, especially cooking competition shows. America's Test Kitchen, Chopped, Cutthroat Kitchen, Tournament of Champions, and of course the original and the classic and the best, Iron Chef. Now imagine an episode, maybe of Iron Chef, where one contestant has made the great salt discovery. And I'm pretty sure this is against the rules, but just imagine that they secretly smuggle in a thimble full of salt in her pocket. She smuggles it in, you know. And at the very last minute, the timer is counting down, and she sprinkles at the very end some salt on top of the meal and slides the plate. Imagine that moment when the panel judges all take their first bite, and for the very first time, they taste a meal with salt on top. What would they think in that moment? How would they react? What expressions would immediately appear on their faces, tasting salt for the first time? What words would they have to invent to communicate their thoughts and feelings about the food? How wonderfully just a little pinch of salt can take a meal, a fine meal, but make it glorious. We would say, in terms of food preparation and recipes, we would say that salt completes the recipe. Jesus uses similar words here. He talks about the way that salt perfects or fulfills. Salt flavoring a meal. This is Jesus' opening example in the Sermon on the Mount. We are that to the world. We are the salt of the earth. Jesus declares it. And then in this sermon, he shows us how to stay salty, how not to lose our flavor and become something like flavorless table salt. A ridiculous thing to keep around on your table, as we saw and joked with Jesus last week. Jesus starts with the Beatitudes. He blesses the ones who were being wronged. He pronounces a blessing upon those who bear up under persecution and mistreatment with a poverty of spirit. Under circumstances like that, he blesses those who in circumstances like that make peace, accomplish peace. These are amazing traits. They are outstanding qualities in the world. They are the traits of salty salt, salt that still tastes like it. But we looked at this and now have been tracking with this for several weeks. The Beatitudes, again, they just can seem so otherworldly that they're just ideals that don't really connect with our lives, our real lives in the real world, where all the bad stuff actually happens. They can seem unrealistic, maybe more poetic than they are practical. So this next part of Jesus' sermon, he's going to answer what those Beatitudes actually look like in the real world. What are the practical outworkings and applications of beatitudinal salty living? And in the passage I just read, he gives us three, sort of, Matthew loves to use what they call triads, threes, and that makes my job a little bit easier, so we can kind of track with the threes. In this passage before us, he gives us three examples: wrath, speech, and reconciliation. So we're going to track with those and then close with an application. So first, he says in verse 21, and he's going to repeat this phrase again through this section of his sermon, "You have heard it said to those in ancient times." He's referring to the giving of the law. This, you can find it in Exodus 20, and of course you can find it again, the second giving in Deuteronomy 5. You've heard it said, you shall not murder. Murderers will be judged. And this is true. That was said in Scripture, repeated, and it's true. We all know it. But of course, murder is the outer limit, right? Murder constitutes the extremity of the law, what's allowed and what's not. So Jesus starts way out there because, well, let's face it, that's often where we start when we are attempting to justify ourselves. We go way out to the outer limit. People commonly say things. You know what? You've heard this before. Well, I've never murdered anybody, so I'm not doing too bad. I think that helps establish the case. I'm basically a good person. There's a Christian version of that. Many of us are too far along in our faith or sophisticated to say something like that, but there is, you know, a Christian version might go, well, I'm against murder, and I'm against all forms of murder. I'm against abortion and euthanasia. I believe in the death penalty as the just punishment and deterrent for murder. And holding views like that and expressing views like that is what makes me salt and light in the world. But neither of these things, as good as they are, actually do make us salty. Neither one actually gets to the heart of the matter. And they're clearly not what Jesus is talking about here, because he continues the discussion a very different direction. Instead of congratulating his disciples for having managed somehow to avoid murder charges, and also for not congratulate, he doesn't congratulate them for advocating for the right public policies on things related to the protection of life. Again, as important as these things are, and they are important, instead, Jesus presses the discussion in a radically different direction, radical in the true sense of that word, to the root. We might put it this way. Instead of asking, what is the sixth commandment, which I hope that after a minute of thought and maybe some coffee or something, you could get that right. But Jesus is pressing it in a different direction. He's asking maybe more along the lines of, why is the sixth commandment? In other words, sixth commandment is, thou shalt not kill. Why did Yahweh our God forbid killing? Is it just there's something about the physical act of killing that he doesn't like, it's offensive to him? Maybe he's like I am. The sight of blood grosses him out. It makes him feel woozy. Is that it? Probably not. Then why did he give the sixth commandment then? Is there something deeper beneath the sixth commandment? Does he just like making rules and then seeing people follow rules? Jesus knows better. Jesus knows that the sin of murder is really just the tip of an iceberg. And the entire iceberg is contrary to the will of God. It is harmful or maybe offensive to the heart of God. He knows this because he's the Son of the Father, one with his Father. Murder is the exact opposite of God's will, because God desires his creatures, and in particular here, his image bearers, humans, to love and serve one another. Simply not murdering your neighbor does not mean you are loving and serving your neighbor or your brother. Refraining from murder doesn't positively fulfill any of the will of God. It's a negative thing and not a positive thing. In fact, there are all sorts of ways that we as non-murderers can really fall short of God's will with regard to our neighbors. So Jesus is going to press this a little bit and show us. He says, I say unto you, whoever is angry with his brother shall be in danger of the judgment. Harboring anger in our hearts, that particular kind of anger that we have toward brothers, we might expand that to sisters, toward the people that are closest to us, actually. There is a particular level of frustration that builds between those who are closest. This is a failure to fulfill God's will, the will beneath that command. This kind of anger is wrong for the same reason killing is wrong. Now, many Christians have noted, wait, not all anger is sinful anger. Hold on a minute. There is such a thing as righteous anger, and that is certainly correct. It's helpful here, since the parallel is in place, to maybe think of it this way. Not all killing is sinful. There is such a thing as righteous killing, but let's face it, that's a really rare thing. Thanks be to God, most of us will never experience righteous killing and the responsibility of carrying that out. And it's probably a helpful guide for us in thinking about righteous anger also. I mean, let's be honest, saints. We use this excuse way too often. The anger we feel can very rarely be honestly labeled as righteous anger. So Scripture warns us about anger all over the place. In addition to tons of the Proverbs, which I encourage you to go home and look up and think through, Ephesians 4:31, let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. Colossians 3:8, but now you also put off all these things, anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy or speech against, filthy communications out of your mouth. 1 Timothy 2:8, we've looked at not too many months ago. I desire that men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands in worship without wrath or doubting. The prohibition to pray in public when you're angry. Because, James 1:20, the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. Now, Jesus is not teaching here that anger and murder are the same. In every respect, of course, they're not, contrary to pietistic opinion. All sins are not equal. So says the Bible, so says the Westminster Confession very clearly. It's not like you can say, well, I've been angry with this guy for quite a while, so I might as well just kill him since they're the same. They're not the same. Please understand the difference and appreciate it, especially if you happen to be angry with me. Jesus' point is not that these sins are the same in every way. He's making a different point. The point is this: murder doesn't just sort of appear out of the blue. Murder is like the flower on top of a plant that has a root. Where does murder come from? One of the roots, the main root, is anger. Wrath. That's the root. All murders began with Cain, who murdered his brother. And that began with his wrath, his anger toward his brother. So if we want to actually be salt, remember that's the goal here. If we want to actually start to do something the right kind of different, maybe even positively, if we actually want to uproot murders and rid the world of some murders, if we want to actually honor the heart of God that we can trace beneath those commandments, we have to start by ridding our own hearts of anger, the root of the sin, the extremity of its expression. We must refuse to carry around the bitter embers of resentment. We must refuse to carry around the bitter embers of resentment. If someone has wronged you, you have two choices. My mentor, Greg Strawbridge, taught me this. Christians have two choices only and ever. If they've been wronged, if they've been offended, you can choose to A, cover it over with love and forgive it automatically. Or B, you can address it with the person who has wronged or offended you. But you got to do that with the poverty of spirit that Jesus is talking about here, right? You're not doing it if you start off with, you know, like we're all tempted to, like, what's your problem? You know, that's not a good start to that conversation. Either way, the goal is the same goal. The same goal, either way, forgiveness, reconciliation, which is the goal beneath the commandment, right? Remember the goal of God in these commands. love and service of our neighbor, the good of my neighbor. I want to repeat for you something I think is very helpful and valuable. We have those little booklets. I don't think I've ever highlighted this next to our mailboxes over there, but those little counseling booklets, we call them the mini books, and they're intended to be the kind of thing you can read in just a quick sit down and read through. We have a couple of them over there specifically devoted to forgiveness, and a name you may remember hearing, Ken Sandy, who's a minister, and his focus is mediation and peacemaking. He started a ministry called Peacemakers. He does a great job of emphasizing that every time we say, I forgive you, we're making a promise, and there are four components to that promise. These are the four promises of forgiveness. Number one, I will not dwell on this incident. Number two, I will not bring up this incident again to use against you. Number three, I will not talk to others about the incident. And number four, I will not let this stand between us or hinder our personal relationship. It's a great description of everything that's behind those words, I forgive you. The commitment, the promise of forgiveness. Okay, so that's a quick snapshot here. We want to be salty salt. First step, we have to rid our hearts of the root of murder, bitterness, anger. We have to refuse to carry around wrath and resentment toward others. Okay, second step, Jesus turns to our words, our speech. You saw that same pattern and turn in so many of the New Testament scriptures, that they're like brother and sister, right? You put off your anger. Oh, and by the way, put off the way you speak that anger. In his day, just like our day, freedom of speech was not an absolute thing, his being Jesus. In Jesus' day, you didn't have freedom of speech. This is something noteworthy, especially, I think, for our young people. This is coming up a lot in our Sunday school hour. We look at different cultural issues. We continually look at the idea of in America, our legal protection under the First Amendment, which is the freedom of speech. But that legal category is not an absolute category. It doesn't mean we can say whatever we feel like whenever we feel like it. That's not what even the legal category is. There are all sorts of good limits on our ability to open our mouths and say things. And a big common example of this are laws that prohibit libel or defamation. Kids, those are really big words, I know. But they just mean that you can be taken to court, you could be punished legally for saying bad things about another person in public. It can actually be illegal to say something bad about somebody publicly in a way that harms their reputation legally. So there are laws against it. Johnny Depp comes to mind, right? And all sorts of other famous modern examples where there's actually a big trial for libel, for saying something bad about someone. Same thing actually in Jesus' day for different reasons, but there were protections in place. You could be taken to court for public insults or defamation. Especially back then, there was much more of what they called the honor society and culture at play. Jesus says, shouldn't worry so much about those laws. Speaking in a way, trying to figure out a way to speak so that you can get away with it legally or don't get dragged to the Jerusalem court. Worry instead about God's court. Don't worry so much about a fine. Worry about a fire. It may be bad to stand before an earthly judge. Often it is. It's much better most of the time to settle out of court. And I'm no lawyer, you know that. But that's what I understand most lawyers advise. Don't let this thing go to court. Figure out a way to cut your losses before you get into the battle, because once you're in the courtroom, it may go really badly. Jesus says, the worst case scenario is that the whole court turns against you and you be thrown into prison until you pay every last penny. How about you figure out a way to cut your losses right now? Now, in Jesus' day, it was illegal to do this, and certain things you weren't allowed to say publicly. You weren't allowed to call people certain names, really bad public stuff, just like today, legally. You know, if you go in print or something public, you can't speak a certain way about people. But normal everyday outbursts and insults and put downs, well, those were just normal. Jesus says, but if you use those, you just blurt out, you fool, you're on the path that leads to hell. Now again, don't miss the point. Don't hear this like a Pharisee. It's not like, oh, Jesus has banned the word fool. Lucky for me, I know other words. Dummy. He didn't say dummy, or imbecile, or cotton-headed ninny muggins. Kids, that's not what he means. Think about it for a second. When somebody cuts you off in traffic, what do you shout out? What do you gesture? Now think further. Think the next step. How do they respond? And then think the next step. How do you respond when they respond? And then think the next step after that. Where does all that lead? Murder, the thing Jesus is talking about. We call it road rage. It's amazing, isn't it, how quickly that takes over? Isn't it? According to a major study released last year, on average nationwide, someone was shot and killed in a road rage incident every 17 hours. That's more than one a day, to state the obvious. That's 522 people were shot and killed in 2021 in a road rage confrontation in our country. Now, one response to that is to think, well, the solution must be I need to start carrying a gun when I drive. But Jesus wants us to think differently. Jesus wants us to think the solution is actually I need to guard my tongue and bite my lip when I drive. When that guy cuts me off, I need to not say anything. Most of the time, we do this, right? Christians say, well, I didn't cuss at him. That's not salt. We could choose lots of words and lots of responses that still continue that cycle that might just lead to murder. The same thing. See what a forest, a little fire kindles. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. Out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. Somehow in our culture, the phrase salty language has come to be used to describe the kinds of things Jesus is prohibiting here. But if we want to actually be salty according to Jesus' definition, it's going to be saying opposite things and doing opposite things. Words are truly salty when there are words of love, meekness, words of blessing that are returned for cursing. What is the sixth command? Why is the sixth command? If we want to actually do something positively to rid the world a little at a time of murder, if we want to actually honor the heart of God behind commands like that, we have to learn to bridle our tongues. If we want to be salty salt that still has its flavor, we've got to guard our mouths and refuse to say the kinds of things that just initiate the age-old cycle of wrath and vengeance we find all around us, the kinds of things that so naturally and easily just flow out because of our, what Paul said in our epistle, our carnal flesh, right? Our instincts, They just come so naturally, but they are the things that lead to murder. Okay, third and finally, Jesus says, if you bring your gift to the altar, your sacrifice, your offering to the altar, and there, isn't it funny how these things work sometimes? It's like all of a sudden you remember your brother has something against you. Leave your gift there at the altar and go your way first. Be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift. Agree with your adversary quickly while you're on the way with him, lest your adversary deliver you to the judge, the officer to prison, and you're stuck there till you pay the last penny. I can remember a few years ago, one of you members of the church, you got here, we were in the old building, worship had just started, everybody had gotten seated and settled, and then one of you popped up, walked outside, got in a car, and drove away. I didn't really notice it, but afterward we talked, and you said, I hope I wasn't distracting. It was kind of odd what I did. You said, I had this as soon as, you know, the call to worship. It's funny how you just remember these things all of a sudden. I sat down, heard the call to worship, and I had this vivid picture in my mind. I remember taking a pot off the burner, the gas burner, and I couldn't remember, did I turn off the gas burner this morning when I was cooking? And I was trying to remember, did I turn it off? And for some reason, the vivid memory was the thing still burning and me walking away. I just thought, I got to go home. I got to check. Did I leave the gas burner on? That's a good thing. It's a good thing. Wise to turn around and go home and check things like that. Well, it's the same idea here. We sometimes say that worship is the most important activity a human being can engage in. Worship is our highest and our holiest calling. And certainly from one perspective, that is true. But there is another perspective in which that is not true. In this passage, Jesus says, if you enter into worship, the highest and holiest calling, but you remember in that moment, I mean, isn't it funny how our memories sometimes just God puts these things in our minds. You remember something else. Stop, turn around, go deal with that thing first. Then come back and worship. So if you pull up to worship and you've been quarreling and you know your brother or your wife or your children have something against you, now just notice the little reversal here. Now it's no longer me and my grudge and my anger. It's what I've done. I've been the one that's done something, and I remember they've got this against me. You're in the wrong. You pull up for worship. Don't just walk in here and try to worship like everything's fine. Stay out there in your car with them. Humble yourself. Confess your sin. Be reconciled first. It is more important that you stay out there in your car and settle accounts with your brother, your wife, your children, whoever, then for you to come in here and stand before God, who is the judge, who sees and knows. Now that may seem radical. It's nothing really in comparison to what Jesus said here, literally. Think about it for a second. He's preaching in Galilee. The sacrifice at the altar he's referring to is a rare thing to perform in his day. In order to get to the altar in the temple from Galilee, you'd have to travel 3 days. There you would find the temple in Jerusalem. Now imagine arriving, getting there. Have you ever had to travel 3 days to get somewhere? You know, we talked about this in Sunday school. It's rare to have to take that long to get anywhere nowadays. But just, you get there, and you realize, right before you go to do the thing you went there to do, my brother, I offended before I left. I said that, or I did that, and I offended my brother. He's got something against me. Instead of doing the thing you came to do, right then and there, you drop it, right there. You turn around Does Jesus mean you turn all the way around and go back 3 days to Galilee and you find your brother? Could be what he means. Maybe he means your brother came down with you for the feast or whatever. But you drop your offering off, and now you're in Jerusalem with 1 million people and no cell phone. Go find your brother. Be reconciled. If you can do that in time and get back to make your offering, go ahead and do it. If not, make your reconciliation. God doesn't need your offering. Jesus is talking, either way, he's talking about something really radical. Prioritize reconciliation. Don't think you can bribe God. Don't think you're okay because you make the offerings. It doesn't matter how I treat my brother. Drop your offering at the altar and go be reconciled. Why? Why is that? Because what is an offering? It's us. That lamb is us. And that lamb, we know this, it was never allowed to bring a blemished lamb. But that lamb is us. We can't present ourselves, our worship, our praise, if it's tainted with impurities of heart, offenses against our brothers, blemishes in us. If we want to actually rid the world of murder, if we want to actually honor the command of God, positively do something that manifests God's heart behind the commands in his world, we have to humble ourselves. It looks like being proactive when there's a beef, an offense. We must seek peace with everyone as much as it is up to us, Romans 12:18. If we want to be salty salt, we've got to be radical about rooting out murder, resentments. We've got to be radical about seeking reconciliation. We've got to guard our tongue and not say the things that continue us down that path. We've got to be willing to yield when others have something against us. Very eager to confess and make peace. Confess your sins to one another, Scripture says. Seek reconciliation. We cannot be the kinds of people who simply let things smolder. We cannot be the kinds of people who rely on, well, it's not prosecutable. Well, I'm not guilty of murder. The kinds of things Jesus is commanding us here, we're going to see ongoing, these are the kinds of things that actually have the power to reverse the cycles of wrath and sin and vengeance and murder. The kinds of things that actually can freeze and reverse the cycles of betrayal and misery in the world. These are the things Jesus says, give us flavor out there. So I want to invite you again, imagine a different kind of world. Imagine the kind of church we would be if we all took seriously Jesus' command to purge our hearts of anger and resentment. Imagine the kind of family you would have if you guarded your tongue and you just put away all harsh, bitter speech. Imagine the kind of community this would be if we went on the active. We went out of our way to pursue peace, to broker reconciliation with others when we were estranged from them. If we took the initiative, if we went to our family when we knew they had something against us, we went to our friends when we realized that we had offended them. If we ask forgiveness without them having to struggle and figure out how to address it or whether to address it with us, if we sensed it and we initiated reconciliation. This is the difference that matters. This isn't the difference between good eggs and bad eggs, like we saw last week. This is the difference between good eggs and salt. And this is what Jesus' sermon is all about. So may we be the salty difference in his world by his Holy Spirit's power. Please pray with me. when we think about the sixth command, our Westminster Catechism really shines. It does a great job, and I encourage you to go home and look it up and read through it. I'm going to read you a summary of that catechism answer to the question, what does the sixth command require? What's really behind this? And as you hear these things, ask yourself, do these describe me? Do these describe me at home? Do these describe me at work? Do these describe me with my family? Do these describe me at church? Are these the kinds of things that my neighbors see from across the street? Are these the kinds of things that my family members, extended family members, would say to describe me from out of state? These are spiritual descriptions of the flavor of salt. So what does the sixth command require? The sixth command requires us to resist all thoughts, purposes, passions, occasions, temptations, practices, and whatever else tend to the destruction of life. We must patiently bear the hand of God with quiet minds and cheerful spirits. We must make sober, moderate use of food, drink, medical treatment, sleep, work, and recreations. You didn't know that part was in there, did you? We must have charitable thoughts, love, compassion, meekness, gentleness, kindness, peaceableness, mild and courteous speech and behavior, forbearance, a readiness to be reconciled, patient bearing and forgiving of injuries, and returning good for evil. Finally, we must comfort and support the distressed, and we must protect and defend the innocent. What a great description. These are the things beneath that command. Please pray with me.